You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Dr. Ian McInnes is back to talk about the seminal agreement between Tyrion and Bronn and the beginning of an important relationship there. Dr. McInnes is senior lecturer at the University of Highlands and Islands. His book is Scotland's Second War of Independence, 1332 to 1357. Steve and I will continue our journey through Season 5. Today we're covering the High Sparrow. A lot happens this episode. And in my bird's eye view, we will continue the theme of knighthood. Specifically, I'm asking the question, how does one become a knight in Westeros? There seems to be some contradiction in the primary documents. Without further ado, here is Dr. Ian A. McInnes.
Middle of the afternoon here. It's been a rather wet and soggy day here in the Highlands. I had to rescue my cat from the rain. I was in a two-hour meeting, which she was outside for all of, and then came in looking rather bedraggled.
And this cat has a name?
She's called Chloe. So she's locked away now, so she can't annoy me.
All right. Well, hopefully she's warm and getting drier.
I did dry her off when she came in, so she should be okay now.
All right, then. Ian, we're talking about Tyrion's sixth POV chapter. I feel like there's a lot that happens in this chapter, even though it's mostly just dialogue.
Yeah.
There's a lot of strategic work that Tyrion's doing in this chapter.
Yeah, I think there seems to be quite a lot of kind of foreshadowing of things to come. I don't know, I might be giving Martin too much credit, but it does seem to presage things that will happen down the line.
Say more about that. So foreshadowing what?
Well, I mean, the obvious one is that the relationship between Tyrion and his father, you know, when he tells the story of his marriage as a young boy to the girl Tysha, and then his father then obviously breaking it up and dealing with the pair of them quite abysmally. But there is that early suggestion already.
Well, and then Bronn says, you know, I would kill a man. I don't care who he is. I'd kill the man who did that to me. And
Tyrion responds, you may get your chance. perhaps thinking that someone else will do the deed for him rather than doing it himself, as he ends up doing.
Yeah.
It does very much demonstrate the state of the relationship between father and son. And that's before we get into any of the other issues that separate the two.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to read a short synopsis of this chapter, and then we can talk about it.
Okay.
After riding all day, Tyrion and Bronn are camped near the high road, heading down the mountain. Tyrion suggests a fire and some game for dinner, if Bronn can manage it. Bronn observes that doing so will surely bring the mountain clown, the mountain clans, not mountain clowns, that would be a whole different story, the mountain clowns down upon them. But Tyrion has a plan that involves being found. The night darkens and they eat roasted goat and talk over old and new relationships. Eventually, Tyrion sleeps. He's woken by Bronn and finds that they are surrounded by stone crows. After several threats and insults, Tyrion asks the stone crows to escort him safely down the mountain. In exchange, he will give them the Vale of Arryn. So, Ian, what do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
I suppose I was going to raise the theme of Bronn as the kind of mercenary warrior, if that would be of interest.
I would love to talk about Bronn. Bronn is one of the very few characters that we've met in this book so far that is lowborn, quote unquote. To me, he's fascinating. I would love to talk about him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gives a proper insight into him and his his thoughts and his beliefs, although some of that comes from not from him, but from Tyrion's rather accurate reading of him. But that whole idea of Bronn as the sellsword, as the mercenary who's willing to fight for anyone who's willing to pay him, and seeing, you know, changing sides as opportunity demands, but falling into this relationship with Tyrion, which will be, you know, long lasting and ultimately will be incredibly advantageous for Bronn himself.
Yeah, everything we know about Bronn is either from Kat's perspective or Tyrion's perspective so far. And so what's Kat's perspective of Bronn? Well, he moves like a panther, and, you know, he's like a cat, and the sword is part of his own arm, and he's this killing machine, basically. Mm. And, you know, he's laughing too often at Tyrion's stupid jokes. And Tyrion goes so far in this chapter as just directly call him scum.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that, like, all right, so maybe Bronn is scum, you know, maybe he is just a killer. But I think it's important to note that we're really seeing the perspective of this particular character from someone who is, you know, a member of the social elite, right? Mm.
But I think at the same time, Tyrion makes it very clear that, you know, he doesn't care. You know,
yeah,
he calls Bronn out on his humble, you know, beginnings, but that's in itself is not a problem. I think Tyrion values him for what he is. That idea of the sword being an extension of his arm, I mean, that we'll come back to that at various times, that he is obviously a skillful fighter, and Tyrion even goes so far as to suggest that he's almost as good a swordsman as Jaime, and you know, Jaime's supposed to be one of the greatest swordsmen in the land, so you obviously recognize his innate skill and talent.
I want to read this one passage. It's here's Bronn talking with Tyrion. Bronn is recounting why he killed Chigan along the road, and Bronn says he was as good as dead, and his moaning was going to bring them down on us. Chigan would have done the same for me, and he was no friend, only a man I rode with. Make no mistake, dwarf, I fought for you, but I do not love you. I mean, you could read that in two ways. You could read Bronn saying, I do not love you, in the sort of the modern sense, like, hey, we're not friends, I'm not doing this because, you know, we're friendly. You know, I'm not your big brother beating up the school bully or whatever. You could also read this with this ancient political sense of love, where you've got this relationship between the lord and the lesser lord, where the more powerful lord basically takes care of those in his purview. And in reply, the lesser lord pledges love to the more powerful lord. And love in this way is always used as sort of this political sense. This is much, I guess this is maybe clear in the ancient world, maybe not so much in the medieval world, but maybe it is. Do we see that kind of political love language in the medieval period?
I think to an extent. I mean, I think there's always that element of a reciprocal relationship between a lord and a man. And the man can be, you know, as you say, a lesser lord. It can be a knight, or it can be someone further down the chain. But at all times, there is a reciprocity. You know, the lord should look after the man. He may put him up in his household. He may feed him. He may clothe him. Provide him with robes and take him into his service. In return, the man is there to fight for him, to fight with him, to be loyal and to be, I suppose, honorable to an extent.
And loyalty there sort of is a stand-in for that word for love, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that would be the way to look at it.
And of course, Bronn is sort of shitting on this arrangement. You know? He's saying, look, this is not a vassal-suzerain relationship. I'm not going to raise my banners and come to your aid simply because of honor. You don't love me. I don't love you. If there is money to be had, that's where I'm going to be.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that he comes up with that great line of, don't go looking for me to bend the knee and malord you every time you take a shit. I'm no man's
story. Right. That's right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a transactional relationship. And I suppose that doesn't mean that the kind of reciprocal relationship that I just referred to is any less of a transaction, but I think there's less romanticism of the relationship. There's less, it is purely he gets paid, and he will protect Tyrion. And Tyrion recognizes that absolutely when he goes back to that point about if I die, the money stops, you know, and you'll be the only one to mourn me at my funeral. So I think each of them go into the relationship knowing exactly how they relate to each other. But I don't think that's, again, I don't think that's completely out of place. A lot of, again, kind of medieval examples will have men fighting for money and changing sides whenever the money runs out or you know, more money is offered. It may have been medieval soldiers were sometimes frowned upon for taking money, and that kind of before the 14th century, you have a situation where the lords especially would refuse pay because being paid for military service was seen as a negative thing. But as the medieval period progresses, once you get into the later, the 14th century onwards, pay for military service and money are absolutely intertwined. So the divisions between why the different reasons as to why you serve are becoming far more muddled, and people serving for honor, people serving because they're fighting for their lord, and people serving for money are all essentially doing the same thing. And so I think, again, Bronn rather usefully sits there and challenges the assumptions of the Westerosi knights and the nature of Westerosi society. And he's quite happy, I think, doing that. But that's why he's also kind of frowned upon and treated as something lesser, although Tyrion largely doesn't do that because he recognizes exactly what their relationship is.
And then there's that little line that I read. It has kind of this bookend a little bit later. Tyrion says. He says, "Did I offend you? My pardons. But you are scum, Bronn. Make no mistake." So it was sort of like, you know, Bronn said, "Make no mistake, I do not love you." Tyrion replies and says, "Make no mistake, you're scum." You know, they're kind of exchanging barbs, but that'd be an odd thing to do, to exchange bards. I'm done with this musician. You may have him, sir. Now they're exchanging barbs, but it's true. He absolutely is in a position of a lord, but he's not a lord that's owed any love. Ooh. And Bronn is in a position as sort of as a hired sword, and Tyrion, you know, is not going to blow any smoke up his ass. From my perspective, you're scum. This seems to work for their relationship, I guess.
I suppose I think Tyrion is almost kind of playing with Bronn in terms of how he sometimes treated himself. I mean, Tyrion is, as we've seen, looked down upon by, you know, the rest of Westerosi society. He's looked down by members of his own family.
Right.
You know, so he perhaps sees in Bronn something of himself. I mean, they share or will share various pastimes, whether that's drinking or gambling or whoring. You know, he is a lord, but I think he recognizes his own position is not in any way solid. The main reason that he's treated with any kind of deference at all is because of who his father is, who his family is, and how much money his family has. And without that surname, I think Tyrion would have been, and as we see later on when he kind of loses all that, you know, he's in danger of becoming something far less.
Yeah,
it's all these wits that get him out of it.
That's right. And, you know, we could talk a little bit more about Tyrion, but I want to make sure that we, you know, we give Bronn his due because he is such an interesting character. And I really haven't had a really great opportunity so far to talk about him on this podcast. One thing that Tyrion says to Bronn is that you took up Lady Catelyn's cause because you saw an opportunity. But at the end of that relationship, it would have been very distasteful. Here's a few coins. Thank you for escorting me to Winterfell, sort of thing. In other words, there wouldn't have been a long-term benefit for Bronn as sort of a member of the guard of House Stark or something like that. Because the Starks value honor, or at least that's Tyrion's perspective, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, Tyrion says, of course, but with me, it'll be different because I don't value honor. I'm much more practical, and I think that you're going to be happier in my service.
But I think that later on you'll see that Tyrion does get unhappy when Bronn does exactly what Tyrion accuses him of doing. You know, he takes the knighthood that's given to him by Tywin, and Tyrion is annoyed at that because he almost sees that as a betrayal. And then as Bronn himself advances, he loses Bronn as that kind of companion and mercenary, because Bronn has now elevated himself into the ranks of those who he often despised.
Well, and in that way, Bronn and Shae have a parallel.
Yeah.
Because here we go, you know, here's Tyrion has basically had to buy a friend in Bronn, and he's had to buy a lover in Shae. And as long as those two are in his employ, they're very loyal. As soon as there's no money being exchanged, you know, and maybe Shay's different because, you know, it could be that she actually did love him. But that's part of Tyrion's predicament. How would he know? Like, how would he know how much Bronn does really enjoy his company, or how would he know how much Shay does love him? Because, of course, of how they began their relationship. It was very transactional.
The other comparison is between Bronn and with Podrick, who I suppose kind of takes over that position for a while anyway, in Tyrion's service, and it's a very different relationship. I mean, Podrick Payne is a Lannister retainer and is properly in the service of Tyrion, whereas Bronn is very much fulfilling that transactional part of things, and they are two completely different figures. But in terms of the relationship that Tyrion has with them over the longer term, I think they are quite different. And obviously the pathway that both the characters kind of follow is with rather differing results. I mean, I think Bronn ultimately is just, yeah, I think he is out for himself. He is there to earn as much money as he can and to advance himself where he can. I don't think there's any doubt he has a liking for Tyrion, or he develops a liking for Tyrion. I think he appreciates his no-nonsense approach. He appreciates that he's not your typical lord. He doesn't treat him like crap and expect him to do
Yeah,
what he
sure.
tells him to, although he does treat him badly at various times. But it's the kind of honesty in the relationship rather than anything else. And at that point about, the Starks are looking for honorable warriors, I think that again speaks to the differing nature or the different approaches of these families and the individuals within it. And Tyrion's comment about Eddard Stark and Catelyn Stark and their desire for honor and all the rest of it, I mean, it's said somewhat contemptuously. I don't think Tyrion thinks much of them because of that. And so many other characters will tell them such notions have no place in the society in which they live.
I want to talk a little bit about Tysha. This is the first we're introduced to really sort of Tyrion's, I guess we could call it Tyrion's origin story. So they're waiting, and I think Tyrion knows that lighting the fire is going to bring the Mountain Clans on them, but they might as well talk while they pass the time. And I guess he's got this song in his head that Tysha. Now, we should also say that Tysha is not named. She's just called the Crofter's daughter in this chapter. He's got the song in his head that Tysha used to sing, and then this brings up the story about how he and Jaime chased off these, you know, robbers or brigands or whoever they were. And then, of course, that occasion allows Tyrion to meet this Crofter's daughter. He takes her to dinner, and then, of course, takes her to bed. And then, you know, shortly after, they're married by a drunken septon. And for two, it's like 2 weeks of bliss, 13-year-old Tyrion is married, right? And then, of course, what happens next is that I guess either Tywin or Jaime reveals to Tyrion that she is a sex worker that they've hired to pretend to fall in love with Tyrion. Because, of course, Jaime's just trying to, you know, get Tyrion a girl. And I think later on in the books, we're meant to question this story, but in this one in the story, Tyrion absolutely believes that this is the case. And it ends with this horrific scene of Tysha being used by several of these Lannister guard, and then, of course, paid for her troubles. And Tyrion goes last and pays a gold instead of a silver, whatever. It's just a, it's a, horrific and tragic story. I think it's meant to be tragic for Tyrion, but certainly tragic for her. And then, of course, we have, this is the second time that we've seen a story kind of like this in the story, because, of course, Kat had previously recalled when Baelish, who didn't have social standing, was trying to connect himself to House Tully through Catelyn. And that didn't work out for Baelish. And so you really have this picture of these class distinctions, and the attempt to marry because you've fallen in love ends tragically in this world.
No, and I think it's, well, I suppose it's a couple of things. I suppose it emphasizes the, or it re-emphasizes the nature of society. You know, that it makes no bones about the position of women within Westerosi society, or the structures of society where, you know, the lordly families largely can do what they want with people, and women especially, and that's just how things are. And I think we are supposed to see this as a quite appalling you know, series of events. But you're right, I think, you know, that because it's being told by Tyrion, we do have that kind of sympathy for Tyrion. It's constructed within the bounds of, you know, him being a misshapen dwarf, and the subtext in terms of Jaime thinking he should get a girl is because, you know, what woman would want to be with him? That's the kind of unspoken bit of it when he's telling the story. But yes, also at the same time, the fact that Tywin's parental skills are problematic when it comes to when it comes to Tyrion in particular,
but delicately
as,
said.
Well, yeah, but as we'll see with all these children, is deeply problematic. And I suppose ultimately it comes back to that lingering thing that Tywin ultimately blames Tyrion for the death of his wife, and any opportunity he gets to punish Tyrion is an opportunity. I thought it was quite interesting that Tyrion, when he's telling that story, absolutely lays the blame squarely on his father, and obviously it's the blame for, you know, what happens at the end of the story. But he doesn't seem to lay any blame on Jaime for getting him into that position in the first place. Jaime has effectively set this whole thing up, because, as you said, he thinks it's time that his brother was with a woman. But he doesn't seem to have any, or he doesn't give away any misgivings about Jaime in this particular tale. And indeed, as we'll see as the series goes on, their relationship is actually a very close one, a very strong one. So I think that I thought was quite interesting as well.
Yeah, Tyrion's going to be able to, I think Tyrion's just going to forgive Jaime almost anything. Because I think Jaime's the only one in all of his life that has ever shown him any kindness.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this story is pretty bad. Mm. I mean, this is not a kind story. Either Jaime has lied to Tyrion to get him with a girl, and then allowed this thing to happen, or Jaime has lied for Tywin in telling Tyrion that the woman that he loves is actually a sex worker. In either case, you know, Jaime is not on Tyrion's side. But again, of course, you know, Tyrion's going to forgive his brother almost anything.
I suppose it comes back to, I mean, Jaime is a problematic figure throughout, made more so by obviously the differences between the books and the TV in some parts. Jaime's an ongoing problem. I suppose the other thing in the background is, of course, you know, Martin's treatment of women. If we kind of scale back and look at it as a piece of fiction, you know, it's that assumption that this is how women are treated in certain societies or in certain periods of time. And so this is, you know, it's fine to write about, but, you know, there is a recurring theme throughout a lot of this in terms of the mistreatment of female characters. This is a relatively early example, but there will be plenty more. And I suppose this is where Martin comes in for criticism in terms of how he deals with these female characters and how he uses and abuses them throughout.
Yeah. I think we could even broaden it and say, you know, this is a world where powerful people use less powerful people for their purposes. And I think that, you know, we have a few notable exceptions in this book. But I guess we could also say, look, there's a lot of parallels between this world and our world. Mm. There's always powerful people that will use less powerful people. It's just, you know, maybe it's just a little bit more discreet than, you know, in this feudal system, I suppose.
The worry, though, from a medievalism perspective is that you then get people assuming that this is demonstrative of the medieval, because that's what they expect the medieval period to look like. You know, it's nasty, it's dangerous, it's brutal, that people are all treated appallingly, and women particularly. And that's not to suggest they weren't, but the inherent danger is that comparison made with the medieval is that, you know, it's something that happened a long time ago. And that point you made about what's happening in Martin's own time is sometimes perhaps a bit lost to his modern day audience who associate it with a fictionalized medieval past and not with the present.
Right. Or even worse, if this time period is idealized, you know, these are the good old days. You know, it's like good for whom? good for very few. You know?
Good if you're wealthy. And
yeah, that's right. To the right family and the right gender, and you know, you happen to live in a, you know, little sliver of history where your family's not at war, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm curious, maybe we talk a little bit more about Tyrion's play here. You know, he's already sort of made a play with Mord to get out of the Sky Cells, right? Mm-hmm. He's a desperate man. He's actually thinking about, you know, his own death. He thinks he won't last very long. So he basically used Mord to get out of the Sky Cell, and he sort of used this trial by combat and making this gamble on Bronn's opportunism. And then, of course, he's going to make another play with these mountain clans. So I wonder if we talk a little bit about that.
I think you're right in terms of the desperation. He perhaps doesn't have any choice. But I think at the same time, it's also about him being kind of quick-witted. He can think on his feet. He's almost looking for an opportunity to persuade people. I think that whole thing with the mountain clans is very much about there isn't an alternative. I mean, Bronn obviously thinks that there is. You know, you travel by night, you travel quickly, you avoid being spotted, and you get out of it. And Tyrion's kind of reasoning is sound in terms of, yeah, that's how you fall down a mountain and break your neck. But there's also a bit of, you almost think that he's wanting to confront them. He wants the opportunity to come face to face with them because he believes that he can talk his way out of it. You know, he talks about it in terms of rolling the dice, which suggests that it's, you know, it's random chance. But I think he actually has belief and faith in his own, you know, silver-tongued ability to talk his way out of trouble. And obviously, in this instance, it works. Again, as we'll see as the series goes on, that's not always the case.
Yeah.
But in this one, it is. And he's able to benefit from it.
Maybe this is unanswerable, but you could read this chapter as sort of Tyrion trying to survive, and he thinks his best chance at survival is offering the Stonecrow something that no one else has ever offered them. Recognized land ownership. But there's also part of this that makes me think, maybe he's pissed. Maybe he's pissed at Lysa, and he's thinking, you know what? I can throw my weight around too here. Maybe if I could get these mountain clans to rise up against the Vale, that'll be a nice little retribution for the harm you've caused me.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he is offering something that's not his to give. You know, he's offering them an opportunity and, you know, potentially weapons to make their attempt to take the Vale more practical. You know, instead of the scythes and the pitchforks that some of them are armed with, you know, they can be armed with Lannister weapons and maybe even with Lannister support. So yeah, that makes that a possibility. But ultimately, it's not his to give. And I think as well that in the position we're in the narrative, full-scale war hasn't actually broken out yet. This is still families feuding with each other and maneuvering to take out one or the other. And it's Lannister and Stark, and the Vale is obviously allied with the Starks. But it's not wholesale war as it'll become. And the fact that he's he's offering up the veil. Yeah, I think, as you say, that there may well be a kind of revenge element in it, getting back at Lysa Arryn for her treatment of him. Mm-hmm. But I think also that there is that kind of calculation and that kind of tactical thinking, again, showing that Tyrion can overcome perhaps his physical issues by using his brain, but also that he is actually rather like his father. You know, that there is that he is thinking of the bigger picture. Yeah. He is thinking of how to bring men to his side or to bend men to his will, and how he can use people. Was might be worth thinking about how he does that with Bronn as well. I think in an instance like this, it does actually show that Tyrion is very like Tywin. I don't think either of them would necessarily wish to recognize the fact, but I don't think it's debatable.
In that way, sort of that big picture, and then, of course, the use of the resources around them, and many of those resources being actually other people, you know, those two are both going to use the tools at their disposal to advance. But Tyrion will often use humor, and Tywin does not. Mm, and I think that Tyrion has used humor with both Bronn and the Stonecrows. You know, sort of early on their way up the mountain, Tyrion is sort of telling jokes and getting Bronn to laugh, and of course endearing himself so that people don't just view him in one way. And then, of course, on the way down the mountain, what does he do with the Stonecrows? He makes them laugh. You know, they say, you know, how would you like to die? And he says, I'd like to die, you know, when I'm
in my own bed at the age of 80, with a belly full of wine and a girl's mouth around my cock.
And then that makes them laugh. And of course, that's all he needs is that tiny little connection, that little relational connection, so that he can be heard, you know, so people are not just viewing him as a motley fool who's only good for making the women laugh and milking the cows or whatever. But once he can connect with someone on that level of humor, then they're willing to listen to him. And that's when he pulls out the purse and says, I can make you rich, or I can make you this. And this is your opportunity at advancement. And of course, they're going to listen to that for sure, right?
Yeah, I suppose it's just interesting that he feels the need to have the comedic bit first. Or that's required. I suppose it comes back to who he is, what he is, and what he looks like. And yeah, that comment, kill Bronn, but take the little man because he'll keep the, you know, he'll make the children laugh. I think Tyrion probably recognizes how he's perceived and how he's portrayed, and that even if he does wave the purse first, that won't necessarily break through because they can't see beyond what he is and who he is. And so, yes, he needs that kind of disarming element first. I suppose it goes back to Tyrion having learned harsh lessons in terms of what it takes for people to listen to him, to take him seriously, that he needs something else. And that, again, you know, back to the benefits of being of a rich, noble family, Tyrion should have them, but perhaps doesn't necessarily have them, and that actually he has to do more just to get people to listen to him, despite the fact he's a noble and he comes from a wealthy family.
In our correspondence, you mentioned that the Stonecrows seem to fall into this category of irregular forces, and I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way they're depicted in this episode and in the earlier one where they ambushed Caitlin's troops on the way to the Eyrie, you know, there's almost, I mean, a medieval comparison would be with like the Welsh or the Scots or even the, you know, Scottish Highlanders. You know, they're depicted as these kind of lesser men, less civilized, maybe slightly backward in their ways, whether societally or indeed in their weapons or their armor. You know, they're poorer. They live in the highland areas or the hilly areas away from the agricultural or the agriculturally productive lands of the lowlands. You know, there's plenty of medieval parallels you can make there. But then Tyrion's recruitment of them as that kind of irregular troop, and they do fight with him at the Green Fork, and then they'll fight again at the Battle of the Blackwater. And despite you know, not necessarily being as well armed and as well armored, still fight bravely and fight well and do the job they're intended to do. The, plenty of them die in the process. But I think that there was that, there's that idea as well of them being recruited by Tyrion, just the same as Tywin himself recruits irregular forces. You've got the bloody mummers that we'll see later on, are in Tywin's employ, and they are the, you know, the a useful depiction of irregular forces, forces that you wouldn't necessarily have with you in normal times, in quote unquote civilized times. But in wartime, they serve a purpose. They're there to create mayhem. They're there to cause destruction. They're there to do the jobs that you don't necessarily want to do yourself, and are paid to do so. And then as the war breaks down, as the war progresses, but you know, command and control structures start to fall apart somewhat, they are the forces that then roam around the countryside doing whatever they want in order to take what they need, because they're not necessarily employed anymore. I suppose the Stonecrows don't necessarily fall into that quite as much, although the last scene kind of living in the woods near King's Landing and I suppose kind of scratching out an existence for themselves there, and in which case going over to banditry and almost returning to type in terms of how they're portrayed in this section may well have been how they end up. But yeah, I think it's a nice parallel anyway. In a series that's so fixated at various times on, you know, armored knights on horseback fighting in big battles and the rest of it, that you have other types of warriors who are very different but are still, you know, useful, and that usefulness is recognized by those men who hire them.
Now, in other eras of history, you're mentioning the Welsh and the Scottish forces, which might have been viewed as irregular at times during certain moments in British history, but I guess my question is, a lot of times wartime is a time also for social advancement. So if a warrior who is sort of comes from nowhere, you know, no family, no nobility, whatever, acquits himself well on the battlefield, he might find social advancement if he does well, and, you know, a lord happens to appreciate what he has done on the battlefield. So could a member of quote-unquote irregular forces find social advancement in that way at wartime?
Yeah, I mean, I think something like the Hundred Years' War perhaps has the best examples of those types of troops. You have, you know, England and France are fighting a long war on the continent, and they both require large amounts of troops, either for armies or for garrison service. But the Hundred Years' War doesn't continue for 100 years. Well, it goes on for longer anyway, but it's not one long period of extended conflict. There are pieces and truces throughout the conflict. And during those times of peace and truce, those troops that have been attracted to the conflict or have been hired to serve in it are not getting paid. And even garrison forces are paid essentially half as much in time of peace than they are in time of war. So such men are down on wages or indeed may be deprived of employment altogether. And in those circumstances, they very often band together. They form what are referred to as companies and then start to just kind of raid the countryside and take what they want. Some of them will seize local castles if they can, set themselves up in those as their kind of base of operations, and will then raid around the surrounding countryside, either taking what they want or perhaps more likely extracting kind of protection money from them. That they, you know, saying to towns and communities, okay, you pay us this amount of money and we'll leave you in peace for 6 months. But we'll be back again in 6 months' time. And if you don't pay up, we'll destroy you then. But this happens in France a lot in the 14th century in particular. And you have this idea of the écorcheur, those kind of freebooting warriors who just take what they want. But some of these companies become quite big and become quite organized and are able to hire themselves out to other areas where war is taking place. So when the Hundred Years' War moves to Iberia, there's a lot of free companies go to Spain and Portugal to fight in the armies of both sides. And then they also go to Italy, where, you know, the Italian city-states are almost always at war with each other to some extent. And you have one of the classic examples is the English warrior John Hawkwood, who is a, you know, a relatively low-born individual, rises through the ranks. He's probably begins his military career as an archer, or certainly a foot soldier, and then works his way up to leading a company, and being well paid for his the service of his company in Italy. Dies at the end of his life, is pretty much penniless at the end of it, but still is a man who has risen absolutely through the ranks because of his military service, his military ability, and the company of men he's able to bring around him. One of the other examples in the Hundred Years' War is the French chronicle, or the chronicle by the Hainaulter chronicler, Jean Froissart, writes about this character, the Basque de Molion. And he has this. He meets him in a pub, and essentially kind of sits down by the fireside and has this extended chat with him, asking him about his career and writing down the story of the Basque de Molion's career. And again, it's a litany of service for one side or another, service in this battle or this garrison, but at various other times, just serving in a company, leading a company, and raiding the countryside. You know, Froissart, who's the great exponent of medieval chivalry, he loves writing about chivalric acts, sees no issue writing about this figure who, again, has risen from pretty lowly beginnings to become somebody as a result of his wartime career. Writing about him in exactly the same way as he'll write about, you know, the Black Prince in terms of his chivalry and his chivalric acts. So, yeah, I think, you know, back to the case of Bronn and things, you know, that in the medieval example, I think it would be oftentimes that in the later Middle Ages, anyway, I think there is far less distinction between the different types of warriors. I think what you see in the later medieval period is the elite trying desperately to retain a semblance of difference between them and the other warriors serving alongside them on the battlefield. But those distinctions between them are becoming far more blurred as the period goes on, and that'll only become even more so as armies get bigger, as they become more permanent standing armies in the early modern period, as you get the development of gunpowder weaponry, and that inability, which is already there in the 14th century, but that inability to distinguish between enemies when you're using weapons that can kill people at a distance, how can you behave chivalrically towards them? How can you ensure there's that element of not killing someone who you could hold for ransom? I think all these things are at play in that later medieval period. And so someone like Bronn is quite like someone like Hawkwood, although I think Bronn actually probably rises further ultimately and does better. But certainly the example is there.
So notable introductions in this chapter, of course, the crofter's daughter, who we later learn her name is Tysha. Just because when I first read Game of Thrones, I had to look it up. For some of our American listeners, could you define the term crofter for us?
A croft will be a small piece of land, effectively, on which you would live, and you'll have some land on which you can grow some crop, and perhaps farm an animal or two, and essentially it's for your own use. Although,
yeah, like a sustenance farmer.
Yeah, know, but with the possibility, I suppose, of any excess being sold off for a little bit of profit. But it's it's relatively small scale, so mostly subsistence farm.
Yeah. Okay. So we meet Tysha in Tyrion's memory, basically. We meet Gunther of the Stone Crows, Shaga. Let's not forget Shaga's axe.
Yes.
We meet Shaga's axe, Khan, Torek, and Jagot. Now, notable departures. No one departs in this chapter. However, we do finally hear what ended up happening with Shigen. Shigen departs. Because he's wounded by one of these Mountain Clan attacks. But Bronn, as a good friend will do sometimes, ends his moaning, ends his misery for him by a dagger in the head, basically.
Yeah. Always the practical warrior, Bronn.
Yeah, of course. And then, of course, differences between the show and the book here. The story about Tysha is not brought up in this episode of the show. Tyrion shares this when he meets Shay, and so Bronn and Shay are in the room. Otherwise, this chapter is pretty well represented in the show, I thought.
Yeah, I watched it back, or watched the various episodes containing it, and yeah, it does seem to be quite well replicated. I suppose season one generally sticks to the book quite closely. Yeah. It's when things start to move beyond that that things start to change. But yeah, I had noticed that the Tysha episode had been moved. And I suppose, yeah, it's an interesting editorial choice.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting in that where this is placed. So we really sort of have this mirror between Baelish's attempt to rise the ranks through marriage that go badly and Catelyn's memory, followed by this chapter from Tyrion where, you know, in his memory, he's trying to, I suppose, marry down, so to speak, and that ends badly. In both cases, you know, I think Martin is showing how these sort of class mismatches don't work out. Even if you love the person, these are never going to really work out.
Yeah, I think it's that reinforcement again of the hierarchy within Westerosi society, and that it is a pretty firm and well-established thing. Although, again, as we'll see, Bronn is able to ultimately break out of that and become a lord himself. Although
that's right.
Eventually.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I cover The High Sparrow. This is the episode where Margaery marries Tommen. Littlefinger takes Sansa north to marry Ramsay. Tyrion is abducted by Jorah. And Jon executes Janno Slynt. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, if I was going to cast you either as Frankenstein or Frankenstein's monster, which role would you rather play?
Well, are we doing an authentic Mary Shelley adaptation, or are we following the cinematic version?
I want the Steve Osborne version, and I want you to really explore the space.
Okay, well, then obviously it's going to be a shot-for-shot remake of De Niro's turn as
Frankenstein.
Oh, man, it's funny because I'm a real big fan of the novel.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because the monster is, you know, not really as monstrous as he's depicted, right?
Well, he's a superhero. In fact, I would say that he's the first modern superhero.
Right, yeah. So he's articulate, he's clever,
Yeah, he can like jump like the Hulk or whatever, super strong.
Yeah, so it really is about creation and the relationship with the creator and motivations and all that. I mean, it's great. It's but so cinematically, it's become
much you got Adam typology there, and
right. And but film adaptations tend to focus so much on the up to the creation, and then the monster is almost an afterthought. I mean, I know that like there are these iconic creatures, but not to the, like, they don't create it to have this necessarily this big conflict. It's just that he's a monster, right? And maybe a misunderstood monster. And like it's subtly tries to touch on things, but it's monster.
Yeah, it kind of goes to the success of those early movies, right?
Right.
Forever, sort of the pop culture Frankenstein will dominate our imaginations.
Right. So if you look at it from the novel standpoint, it's like, well, do you want to be the creator playing God, or do you want to be a superhero?
Yeah.
And that's where the question becomes much harder for me.
A superhero without a soul.
So, yeah, that's fine.
And a superhero who's kind of alone in the world. You know, he knows he's the only one. It really is kind of, it's a lot like the mythology of Superman.
You're asking me, like, do I want to be the creature that's afraid of fire and is, like, you know, probably throwing kids in the river or something? That's fine, too.
You know what? I love the book, like you do as well, but for my money, Phil Hartman's depiction of Frankenstein is by far the best.
Yeah, nothing quite like Frankenstein, Tonto, and Tarzan.
Kevin Nealon is Tarzan.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that SNL sketch, look up look up the panel discussion.
Or when they're singing Silent Night.
All right, so we have a little Frankenstein's monster happening.
We do.
I absolutely just giggled with glee when Qyburn just kind of just shushes him.
Yeah.
Easy, friend.
Yeah.
And he's totally just nonplussed by the entire situation. I love that scene. I thought, man, this is kind of a slow drawn out scene where really nothing's happening. Like Cersei wants to send a letter, and so Kyber's gonna sit down and write a letter. It's like, geez, this is, look, I don't as much as I like Hamilton, letter writing is not going to be very dramatic. And
this is where season 5 is just like, I mean, I spent a lot more time on a dictation.
We really need more letter writing in this show. That's what we're missing. But then the corpse of the mountain kind of jolts or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, that was just so worth it. It was so worth the wait. All right. So tell me something about this episode that worked for you.
I like this sort of peak Marjorie Cersei dynamic.
Oh, the tables have totally turned on those two.
We've seen Cersei, you know, she's basically, I mean, Tommen is just, I wouldn't even say he's a puppet, because he doesn't even seem like he's.
No.
It seems like it would be like if Jeff Dunham just put peanut on the stool and the stool just, and he just sat there slumped over during the entirety of Jeff Dunham's act.
Poor Tommen. I mean, no agency at all.
And he doesn't even know that. He doesn't know. You know, it's just, he's, I mean, unlike Joffrey, he was just all about it. Like, okay, I'm the king now. Do whatever I want. Tommen's like, I'm the king. I'm going to eat.
And when Marjorie comes in the room and she's like, you know, she's really distraught. And she says, you know, Cersei's doing this to get back at me. And he's totally confused. He's like, you guys aren't getting along? Like... Oh man, he's just playing that so earnestly, and she realizes how good she really is.
Yeah,
right. She's like, oh, "Of course, he believed every word I said." and then she's able to just kind of slip back into it, and he's just kind of relieved.
Yeah.
Geez, I'm still grossed out by that whole thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, now with no Tywin, with Tyrion sort of bouncing around, and you know, we don't have, you know, in the sense that we lost our heroes to some degree when it,
well, everyone's Rob. Vacated King's Landing.
Right. Yeah. And so now Cersei become like, now we have a chance to really kind of beef up her, her badness. Because, I mean, she was always lurking. Like, you know, she was definitely, you know, pulled mm-hmm. a lot of strings. But, like, when we were really dealing with other plot lines, I think in the last couple seasons, she was more just lurking as a force. And Tywin, and as soon as Tywin showed up on the scene, he kind of eclipsed her. And now she's got such a sphere of influence. And there's such a power vacuum that that someone just has to fill it. And it's not a, and she just took it.
Parallel, what you're saying is that it used to be that the all of the Walls plots were sort of focused on the stuff that's happening around Jon Snow. Mm-hmm. So if you weren't invested in Jon Snow, the plot at the Wall could kind of get a little stale. I feel like it's totally flips now. The Wall is super interesting. And everything that's happening in King's Landing kind of revolves around Cersei. So, but the difference is, I think that we're already like sort of four seasons in and are kind of interested to see what else Cersei has to offer. Anyway, that's how I feel. The wall is infinitely more complex at this point, I think.
Right. I agree. The wall is where, like, now there's, it's interesting that now there's political intrigue at the Wall, where the Wall was kind of a straightforward, like, apolitical, right? This is almost like the politicization of, like, say, like the Department of Justice.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, so you've got these, an institution that's supposed to be apolitical, and then you've got these wildlings that are being held captive. You've got Stannis, and then everything that Stannis brings, right? Bringing the religious fanaticism with him, bringing this weird dynamic between, you know, his daughter and his wife. So you got all that. And then you have the internal machinations of the people who hate John, who are now kind of living under his lordship, I suppose. So one of the major redirections by the show is that Sansa never goes north in the books.
Okay.
What happens is, so Sansa has this friend and she's sort of separated from her friend, and her friend winds up back in the north, and they basically pass this northern girl off as Arya Stark. And what happens is that Ramsay marries fake Arya.
Oh.
So Sansa is supposed to get married to some sort of suitor in the Vale or something under Littlefinger's watchful eye. She never goes back to Winterfell. At least that's where we're at in the books.
Okay.
So this is a major difference. Major difference. And I guess the thing that didn't work for me was how easily Sansa just decides that she's going to marry this guy that she's never met. And she's given a choice.
Yeah.
She's given a choice and she doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to get married to the family that betrayed and killed her brother and mother
in their home.
Yeah. She has a problem with the Boltons for good reason. And she's adamantly opposed to this idea. And Littlefinger just says one or two words and she resolves to just do it. I was really having a hard time with that sort of 180 on her part.
Yeah. I think I'm kind of in the same boat. I think it's because, and it's compounded for me because I'm not quite sure what Sansa is. Is she playing the game? Is she a naive girl? Is she trying to take agency? I mean, all these different questions. And it's like, and now it's like when something like that happens, like, well, okay, it could still be either, right? Maybe that's intentional. I don't know. But like on one hand, I'm like, okay, she agrees. Is she easily manipulated? I mean, that's a big thing to be manipulated into.
Yeah. This is how the last season ended, is that she walked down the stairs. She had the full on, you know, hair color change. She had that kind of
Hollywood Hulk Hogan.
She had the Hollywood Hulk Hogan look. And I believed it. I thought, okay, I'm actually believing that this character who suffered so much is now going to take some agency in her life. And maybe I'm looking at this all wrong. Maybe Littlefinger's like, okay, now I'm going to use this and make her think that she is actually taking control of her life, when really she's still a pawn in my game or whatever. I think that that's how I'm supposed to read it. But I'm just having a hard time. Like, I believe that she was an older, wiser Sansa. And now I'm questioning that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm kind of, that's probably the closest thing. I'll be honest, this episode I didn't have a ton of problems with. And so I'm having this wrestling match right now.
Actually, I liked this episode quite a bit. I was really into this episode. This is the one, I think this may be the one thing that didn't work for me.
But overall, this is pretty good. I mean, like, tonally, I think I've been critical of the first two episodes to some degree. This one felt like a little bit more like we're back into it.
Yeah, I did. I liked this quite a bit. Dismemberment count. Janice gets beheaded.
Yeah, that's a pretty good scene too. I mean, everything in the wall right now is working for me.
It kind of shows the family, the Ned Stark family values. You know, you have to be a person of honor, but you got to be willing to cut off a guy's head, right?
Yeah.
So Ned brought those kids out when they were super young to watch those beheadings. And he really kind of enforced that value in his sons, so much so that, you know, Lord Karstark did not think Rob was going to chop off his head, and he does.
Yeah.
And, you know, so here's the lesson. If there's a boy raised by Ned Stark and you're wondering if he's going to chop off your head or not,
yeah,
he's probably already fantasizing about your head.
And you're going to want Stark blood in their veins if you want a good, clean chop.
Yeah. Yeah, because Theon
was not adept.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because in the book, when Rob tries to chop off Lord Karstark's head, he like tries to use an axe or something, and it takes forever.
Oh boy.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to talk about Bronn's eventual ascent to knighthood. As you might remember from A Storm of Swords, Tyrion wakes up and finds that Bronn is now Sir Bronn, and I'll read this little section. "What is that ugly thing on your chest?" Bronn grinned. "My knightly sigil, a flaming chain green on a smoke-gray field by your lord father's command. I am Sir Bronn of the Blackwater now, imp. See that you don't forget it." So, in effect, Bronn gets knighted off page. Same with the show. He gets knighted off screen. For me, that brings up the question of how Bronn is knighted. It seems like there are multiple, at least dual, but probably multiple ways to be knighted in A Song of Ice and Fire. In A Game of Thrones, here is Maester Luwin's account of how a knight becomes a knight. Luwin says, "To be a knight, you must stand your vigil in a sept and be anointed with seven oils to consecrate your vows. In the north, now only a few of the great houses worship the seven. The rest honor the old gods and name no knights. But those lords and their sons and sworn swords are no less fierce or loyal or honorable. A man's worth is not marked by a sir before his name, as I have told you 100 times before." Luwin's talking with Bran here and explaining to him why northern warriors and northern lords are not called Sir. So really, it would have never been Sir Bran Stark if ever Bran got to live out his dreams. But then the question is Luwin right? Is this a very religious ceremony that only happens if you worship the faith of the Seven? If that's so, is Bronn knighted in a sept? It's possible. There is another option, and that option we see in the Duncan Egg series. How does Sir Duncan the Tall become a knight? Well, he leans on this common notion that any knight can create another knight. And so Duncan just says, "Yeah, well, I was a squire for a while, and before he died, my master made me a knight." But of course, in order to enter the list, he has to be vouched for by another knight. And this is all sort of a word of mouth kind of thing. And I think that the show leans on this a little bit in A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which is, of course, an homage to the Duncan Egg series, when Brienne becomes a knight, simply because Jaime makes her a knight. So how should we think of this? Should we think of it in terms of the any knight can make another knight theory? Or shall we think of this in Maester Luwin's terms, whereby this is a religious ceremony? That is my question to you. Is one of these answers more right than the other? Is one an ideal and the other one's just a shade of the ideal? Or can both of these realities exist simultaneously? Help me think about this. book@baldmove.com. How do you deal with this apparent contradiction? And that is all for this week.